This is SQPN, the StarQuest Production Network, leading the way.
They killed your son in cold blood, and you don't want to stop them?
They didn't kill my son. I did. I brought magic to this world to find Bay. And now he's dead. Magic always is a price, and this is it. I'm prepared to pay it.
Welcome back to The Secrets of Once Upon a Time, and this is it, the discussion of the finale of Season 2 of Once Upon a Time. And joining me is the entire full crew of this podcast, starting with Inge from Groningen in the Netherlands, Deborah, Shelley, David, and Lisa. Welcome to the show, and let me start right away with the first question, and this time it's not what was your favorite moment, but on a scale from 1 to 10, how would you rate this episode? Lisa, what about you?
I'll give it 7.
7 out of 10. Interesting. David. David? You might be muted.
Who's next? I'll go for, I would actually say an 8.
An 8 out of 10. Shelley, what about you?
I was in the 8.5 range, yeah.
Deborah?
Same here. 8.5, somewhere in there.
And what about you, Inge?
6 out of 10.
6 out of 10. Wow, you're very strict with you. I would give this 8.5 out of 10. I really liked it. I wasn't blown away as much as I thought I would be, but I really liked it. So we'll talk about the things we liked, the things we didn't like that much. Once we go through the story, we will try to go through the our review of this episode in chronological order. And of course, we'll save the best for last, which is of course a speculation about the ending, about the cliffhanger, and about season 3. But let me take you first to the start of the episode. We start on Hook's pirate ship. And it starts actually with a reference to a song, and I've got it queued up so we can all get back into the mood. Hook is mentioning this little phrase. Well, of course, he doesn't say a pirate's life for me, but he's telling Bail this is going to be a pirate's life for you. Now, Deborah, you as our resident Disney expert, this is from the Pirates of the Caribbean.
Yes, it is.
Was this part of the original ride?
Yes.
Has this always been the theme song?
It has always been the theme song recorded in the 60s, if you can believe that.
Really? And is it that old? Is the ride that old?
Yes, it is. I believe Walt had a hand in it, even in the planning. Not that he got to see it come to fruition, but the voice you hear in the background of the singing is Paul Frees, who I want to say he did a lot of the voiceover work in the 1960s for like Tiki Room and for a lot of the Disney attractions and Disney cartoons.
Really? Wow. And this song, if I'm not mistaken, was also used in, was it the third Pirates of the Caribbean movie?
Where there's
this scene of where someone is going to get executed. Is that the first scene?
They sing something else for that first scene. But it is used during the first movie, the Pirates of the Caribbean, when Elizabeth Swann and Jack Sparrow are stuck on the island, and they're getting drunk on rhyme and here we go. And so she's singing the song with him while they're sitting on the beach.
Oh, interesting.
And she's trying to get him drunk.
That's Captain Jack Sparrow.
Yes, Captain, sorry.
But I also thought it was sung by this child, I think at the beginning of the I think it was the third movie. I'm trying to look at on YouTube here, if there's a clip of that. Hold on, what am I looking at here? Oh, here it is. Bound her in her bones. The seas be ours and bite the powers. Where we will roam. So there's a public hanging going on. I think that's the moment where... Oh, there you go.
Hands. Hoist the colors.
It doesn't sound like the same melody.
No, it's not. I didn't think it was. I think it's another sea shanty. We need Louisa Pittman to tell us
what
song
that is. Yeah, I was thinking about her.
She's a member of the SQPN community, and she is... also a sailor, actually. She would be perfect for this episode. She could probably tell us also what kind of ship they're using in the series. Anyway, but it's an iconic song, and I love the reference there. And it was almost, he was just not winking at the camera, but he almost was.
Do you know the background of that original song, though? Factoid. I'm sorry.
Sure.
Disney factoid.
I love those.
They actually took the song lyrics from Robert Louis Stevenson's Treasure Island. There's a similar song listed in that book.
Nice.
And so that's the inspiration for Yo-Ho, A Pirate's Life for me.
Cool. I had no idea. Was Pirates of the Caribbean based on that novel or inspired by that or taken from that?
Because they did, I think Disney did a live action Pirates of the Caribbean, or not Pirates of the Caribbean, Treasure Island in the 60s or somewhere, or in the 50s, somewhere in there, where, Walt himself was a big fan of children's literature.
Nice. Well, it turned out to be the golden goose, this whole pirate thing, because it's still around, and my goodness, is it profitable?
Yes, it is.
And that's where the guy liner comes from. It's ultimately from Pirates of the Caribbean. Don't blame this hook. He got it from Pirates of the Caribbean.
So she would just feel sorry for him then.
Oh well, you get used to it. So we then switch to a playground scene, and it's very scary. It's it almost looks like a scene from a horror movie where Gold is watching Henry. On the swing, and he is twitching his walking stick to kill Henry. That's what he tries to do, and he wants Henry to of course make it seem as if it was an accident. But I thought it was pretty gruesome, especially the close up on that pointy rock. And I was like, wow, he is
and
really.
And also, he has no expression on his face. So we have. An earlier occasion where he is dreaming about smashing Henry after changing him into, what is it, China or something like that. And so he's apparently still occupied with his prophecy about
child. He definitely
is.
I mean, he's clearly doing the Voldemort thing here where, this boy has to die so I can live. And then, of course... He is interrupted by Snow and Prince Charming, and they tell him that Balefire has fallen into the portal and is gone. And he reacts like he's as if his son has died, which surprised
me
a little bit.
Isn't that interesting that they all acted like he was dead?
Yeah.
And he went through a portal, which they've all been through portals. So why the... why the assumption?
Well, is it because
he
was
shot?
He was shot.
They said he was mortally wounded.
Well, right, so, but they have stuff on the other side, maybe. I mean, it doesn't equal death. Being shot doesn't equal death. So why do they all assume that he died?
I think they're using it for the plot because they need Gold to think that it's ended, that it's over, that he's lost his son, he's lost his family, he's lost everything, and there's absolutely nothing he can do to get it back. Especially a quote we played at the beginning of this when he says magic has a price and this is it and I'm prepared to pay it.
Yeah.
So, mm-hmm. so why do I care if everything is self? It's kind of a flip from Hook, because Hook in the beginning is so motivated by the revenge that here when he's faced with, I'm going ahead of you, but it's a flip. So, and if we're moving through this chronologically, if we want to go back to that very, very first scene, I think that was, that set it up so perfectly. It set up the whole episode perfectly, because Hook is looking at that drawing of Mila. Yeah. He's in love. I mean, he misses her. He loves her. He's in pain. And, you know, I don't think Hook is quite as evil as we've talked about. He's, you know, we talked about him doing back and forth, doing different things, always in self-interest, always for what's in it for me. But here he's given that choice, what's in it for me. And Smee tells him, look, you've got this boy, and what if this boy belongs to him? If we mm-hmm. give the boy to him, it could be our survival here in Neverland. It definitely changes the stakes. It gives us a status quo, so to speak.
Yeah.
But and Hook's all for it until he hears his name. And he doesn't say it's a pirate's life for you until he hears his name. You know, aren't you quite the hero? That's the other theme that they set up in this. I mean, right there in the very opening scene, they have set up both of the themes: family, self-sacrifice, hero. Boom. And that's what this whole show's been about.
Very good point.
Can I bring up a point about something else that I noticed in this? Taking personal responsibility for your choices and your actions. Mm-hmm. How many characters in this movie said, it's my fault, I'm taking responsibility? Gold said it. Flash forward, I think Regina said it, which was like, whoa.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I wrote down confession, acceptance, repentance, sacrifice. It was all in this episode. That's why I gave it such a high rating. It moved. It set everything up for season three. It got me all excited. I was jumping up and down at the end of the show. I thought about it all night. I thought about it the next day.
Yeah.
Huge themes that they just wrapped all up and gave it to you. And some people might say it moved too fast, or we did things too quickly, and we'll talk about those things. But it was true to the theme of the show.
I agree with you, Shelley. I didn't feel that this episode was rushed or was too quickly. They were able to cram in a lot of themes and a lot of different elements. But as much as I kind of felt that the season finale of the first season was rushed and we hardly had time to develop or to see the development of all these little threads that they were trying to tie together again. This time I felt that this episode was very, very balanced in pacing, and yet it was very deep. We then moved to the mine under Storybrooke. And we see Greg and Tamara, and apparently Greg has an incredible GPS app downloaded from the app store, because normally if you go underground in a tunnel like that, you don't really get the layout of of the tunnels of a mine. But he has even the walls
or
of the...
The, for that matter.
Yeah, reception. And it must be a magical device, because it's mm-hmm. incredibly detailed. And... of course, it is also pointing him directly to this diamond, and you wonder again. It seems to imply that this company that he works for, this Homeland Office, is all about technology, and that it's technology versus magic, and that they are able to use technology in a way that we don't think is possible. Almost like an equivalent in power to magic. I thought it was very interesting to see that GPS. And we've seen him walking around with his cell phone a lot. And
a little bit like James Bond.
A bit. But you do feel that this Homeland Home Office, sorry, I'm confusing this with another series that I'm currently watching. definitely this Home Office is very powerful and very much prepared to face this whatever magic there is, and is able to track it down using technology. And I really wonder how they are going to develop this in season three, and if we are going to understand more about, well, where a device like this comes from. Is this a company that is part of our world, or is it in another realm? Is it in another dimension? It's so futuristic in a way. And yet, you know, his cell phone looks like an ordinary cell phone.
Yeah, and they were not looking for the diamond in the mine because they already had the diamond. What they were looking were the pickaxes.
Yes,
of the
you're right. I'm confused.
And they needed one specific pickaxe. And I just freeze framed it, and they had to use the pickaxe which had the name of Happy on it. So that was bugging me. Why do they need?
That's ironic.
That's a very good detail.
Why do they need the pickaxe with Happy on it to start the switch?
Could be symbolic. Could also be tied
which one
to
of
the
dwarves
character.
Is happy? That's what I was wondering.
Well, Happy isn't that grumpy before he became grumpy?
No.
Happy is dreamy.
Dreamy. Yes, you're right. Huh.
But it is interesting that they had to do that because Goal did not set up the trigger or the self-destruct. Regina said that was hers.
Yes.
She created that.
I was still wondering where they got their axes back in the first. When they got their axes back in the first place, and from where?
Probably in Gold Shop.
There you go.
And like everything else in the world,
the Gold Shop is like a TARDIS. It's much bigger on the inside than it looks from the outside.
But I think this is a very significant scene in those mines, because we get this whole conversation between Hook and Tamara and Greg, and Hook is, you know, who is telling you what to do? And I was immediately, listening. Are we finally going to hear a little bit more about who is giving these directions? And then you get this strange answer like, well, you know, it's not your concern, nor is it our concern who gives these orders. We have faith in the sacredness of our cause. I thought it was a very strange conversation. So they clearly don't really know who commands them. It's this mystery person. Of course, they're setting this up for the end of the episode. But I was wondering, how could they not care about who is giving them instructions? And what is this sacredness of the mission? What do they mean by that? Any clues about that? Any theories?
Well, there was a big clue about that at the end. But, you know, you didn't want me to go all the way to the end.
No, I don't want to get ahead of ourselves.
Thank you, Deborah.
So, no, they said, I'm sorry, no, the phone's ringing. They said that at the end, the person, that they were pawns for something bigger, and it kind of alluded to Peter Pan.
Of course, and I totally understand that.
I'm like, there's somebody more evil than Cora and Regina and Rumpelstiltskin, and it's Peter Pan.
Sure, but my question is not about the mystery person. My question is, what motivates them to not care about who that person is? I mean, they're pawns, but why are they allowing themselves to be pawns? What motivates these two? I know what motivates Greg. It's kind of it seems to be a revenge or magic took away his father, and so he wants to eradicate magic. What about Tamara? What is motivating her ultimately?
I've got a theory about that.
Okay, let's hear it.
So in the past, we speculated that Tamara could be Tinkerbell. But then we abandoned that theory because Tinkerbell is good humor. Tamara seemed to be evil, so she couldn't be Tinkerbell. Mm-hmm. But now we discover that Peter Pan seems to be evil. And we also know that one of the motives of Tamara to endeavor in this whole operation to get rid of magic is something that has to do with her grandmother or great grandmother. I don't remember correctly. So my theory is that she has to be related to a fairy or so like a popular fan theory says, and then also could explain why she could be Tinkerbell. And since Peter Pan is evil, she could be kind of a minion of Peter Pan in this world to carry out his plans.
Well, there's one problem with that theory. The way they tell the story seems to imply that they don't even know that it's Peter Pan. They don't know the identity of the person that is behind the Home Office.
Yeah, but we don't know if what Tamara knows about Peter Pan. So I don't know how they will how do you say that, write Tinkerbell into this story. So if they twist up Peter Pan like this, then they also probably twist up Tinkerbell.
Could like be, but like I like kind of like that idea of an evil version of Tinkerbell teaming up with an evil version of Peter Pan. I still wonder about this whole, you know, sacredness of the cause. It's almost as if they're part of a cult, or but I just can't wrap my head around it. It seems so abstract.
One of the things I thought of, and we had talked last week about Wendy Darling being involved in the Home Office because uh-huh. of the magic and mm-hmm. that storyline there. So when they, and I'm jumping ahead, when they get to the part where they tell Henry that they came here to destroy magic, mm-hmm. but then it all changed.
Yeah.
And I won't go farther than that. Well, my thought was, well, what if Greg and Tamara are somehow connected to the Lost Ones?
Hmm.
And they or the boys that are we know are taken, stolen, and kept on Neverland. Maybe they're not Lost Ones, the ones that we saw during this episode in the Black Hooded, but maybe they're the boys that are held there and not allowed to leave. Maybe some future episode in season 3 comes along and Bay does something, and those boys can return back to Wendy, because the story about Peter Pan is all about going back and forth between Neverland and the Darlings, and then
and about family.
The spinoffs with Hook is right. The spinoffs with Hook, even with the Robin Williams movie, is about how Wendy had the orphanage, ran the orphanage out of the house, and so what if they use that twist and eventually somewhere down a long windy path, Bay is able to send those boys back home. And those boys hate magic. And Wendy creates the Home Office. And Greg and Tamar are part of that. The only thing that doesn't really jive is the sacredness, all the religious language being used at the same time with science. Because, and you made a comment about Tom Cruise and Scientology, but science and religion don't really always line up evenly. And so it's a conflict to me to hear that language with all this scientific technology, but it's the sacredness of our cause, but we're very scientific people.
It's good.
Yeah, but chiming in on the theory that Wendy Darling started the Home Office, of course she lived in the end of the 19th century in England, and starting cults and secret societies was all the rage in that time. So it could also be a part of kind of rituals and those societies were not necessarily religious, but just,
Peter sacredness
Pan
in
is set in the same time period as the Jules Verne stories, mm-hmm. and the Frankenstein was written about the same time period. Mm-hmm. Well, no, Frankenstein's a little earlier, I think, isn't it? The 1820s and 30s, kind of the early late Romantic. But yeah, you're right. You've got that mid to late 1800s going on.
Well, we'll revisit perhaps this conversation a bit later in this episode. Let's first go back to the mines with Hook, Greg, and Tamara.
So you're telling me you don't know who commands you?
Unlike you, Hook, we believe in something. We have faith in the sacredness of our cause.
You're going to destroy an entire town and kill everyone in it.
Yeah. Including your enemy.
Rumpelstiltskin won't be immune to this.
None of your kind will be. Once this thing gets activated, nothing can shut it off.
This whole town will revert to the forest it was.
So tell us, Hook. We're willing to die for our cause. Are you willing to die for yours?
Absolutely.
So lots of interesting elements in this tiny little sound clip. First of all, we get the definitive confirmation that Storybrooke was created by the curse. It's not a village that was already there or a town that was just, you know, enchanted. But apparently before the curse, it was just forest, which is interesting. Why would the curse create a town, you know, there? And I don't know. Explain why it's such a quaint town, so kind of atypical and almost a bit too old-fashioned to be real, because it's the result of a curse. We also hear that the result, once the failsafe or whatever it is activated, Storybrooke will revert, and we actually see what happens the moment they hit the stone or the diamond, and the tower is the first thing, the first building that starts to revert. Yeah,
did
I don't know.
Catch the sign?
No.
The Storybrooke Public Library sign said opening soon.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it said free public library, which I thought was interesting.
It's kind of redundant.
Yeah, aren't they always free?
No, I've never heard of the history of libraries, they weren't always free. They used to be accessible only by subscription.
Oh, okay.
True, but back in the 80s, they used to be free, so I figured that's still kind of odd.
But the library is the symbol of the story itself, and the fact that it's now returning back. It's like the library's full of books. Books are made of trees, and now the whole thing is reverting back to trees. So the books are...
But you saw also those swirls in the clock tower. So that I found that very striking, because so the timer was ticking after Emma entered the town, and now the first thing that's being attacked by this the reversion of the curse is time again.
Well, yeah, it's like it's erasing the time that existed there and everything in it.
And we knew that it was Forrest before, because I can never remember his name.
Bert Flint.
Yeah, the Flint.
And Owen.
They were camping in the woods, remember? And they went to bed and it wasn't there, and then it was there. Mm-hmm. So we knew that it was woods. And so I liked that. It was a surprise to me that it was all going to turn back into Forrest. And I thought that was a really, for the failsafe, I thought that was a nice touch. And then the clock to be the first thing, because it's very symbolic of them being stuck there in time and you know, all of those things, and to have that be the first thing that's getting swallowed up.
Yeah, the story and their story is going to be erased from time and from existence, except of course for Henry, because he was born in our world, so he will survive. But, and this introduces a big theme of this episode, he will be all alone. Everybody he cares for, everybody he loves, is going to be erased, and nobody wants him to you know, to be alone, especially not Emma and especially not Regina. And it's kind of interesting to see Hook, who up until this moment has always said, you know, as long as I get my revenge, for me it's over. You know, the revenge is the end. Remember that him saying that in, I think, the previous episode. And Regina said, no, it's the beginning. And it seemed to me that he had lost any reason to live. He had lost faith, lost hope, lost love, you know, the most important things in life. And so here he says that he, having faced death, he now realizes that he wants to live. Which to me was a bit strange. I mean, okay, now you want to live. Is this a trick? Is he just playing this? What's in it for him? I was still a bit surprised by that change.
I was watching this with a psychologist's eye.
Okay, what?
So I was like, oh, this kind of survival mechanism kicks in.
Preservation.
Self-preservation.
But he's been in these situations before where he was about to die, or he was ready to die, and it didn't kick in back then. So I don't know.
Yeah, but those situations were situations that he didn't plan to die. So it happened. So he was in a situation, and the situation turned bad, and he could die. Mm-hmm. This is something different. By helping them, he just kind of commits suicide, because he plans to die for his cause. And he's too much of a self-interest, of too much, how you say that, egotistic maybe, to do that. He loves himself a little bit more than he hates Rumpelstiltskin.
Yeah. And I saw it as him recognizing that he was part of something, that he finally, more bonding with them. Mm-hmm. And he knew... Yeah. With Bay in there, and with him disappearing, and I love this scene where he finds out that Henry is Bay's son. That was, he's getting the backstory of Bay and Hook together, and then having Hook in town with them and realizing the connection. To me, it was him realizing that he has this broad connection with these people besides just his revenge for Rumpelstiltskin.
He has a huge connection with these people because he was abandoned also. Mm-hmm. He tells Bay that a little bit farther in the episode, but he tells Bay, you know, I was abandoned also. You know,
he
grew up just like Emma. That's why I think they get along so well. And Neil too. There's a theme here that you're either someone who's been abandoned or someone who knows the power of love and family, and how they've each responded to that. And again, in this episode, family. Being part of something. When she comes in and they finally realize, Emma and Regina, we have to work together. Yeah. And Hook comes up out of the mouths of babes, you know, of course, we have to. And then even later, he wants to be part of this family, something bigger than just me alone. Nobody wants to be abandoned.
Yeah, I think this sudden change of attitude from nihilistic, you know, I don't care anymore, and my life is done, and my mission is over. Once I've killed Rumpel, the suddenness of that change, it kind of preludes, you know, his true conversion later on. That there is, mm-hmm. it's not just about him trying to preserve his life; it's about having something to live for, and that is ultimately what brings him back to life, or at least makes him want to live. And so it's interesting. I still feel that it was a little bit sudden, and there are a few other moments where I thought that Hook's behavior was a little bit too convenient or too too quick.
I was thinking especially when we come to the part where Emma throws it at him. So you can choose, or you be part of. You can be part of something, or you can do what you're always good at. And Hook says, "Well, this is crazy." And then Emma says, "Well, Henry just lost his father. I don't want him to lose anybody else." And then Hook discovers that Neil is Bay is mm-hmm. Henry's father. Mm-hmm. And so then later it clicked a little bit in my head. So maybe this is just crazy theory, but what if Bay is not Rumpel's son, but is Hook's son?
That is a little bit too crazy
because,
for me.
When this all happened, this whole prophecy, Mila was home, and Rumpelstiltskin was at the front, and we know after that she ran away with Hook, but you don't know if Hook was visiting the port before that, because they seem to know each other very well already.
Huh. Wow.
She would have taken Bay with him. She would have taken Bay when she ran off to join her. She would not have left that child with Rumpel.
But I
know what Inga's saying, though, because there's a line back where we were in the chronological era where Hook says to Charming, "The things we do for our children."
Yes. I wanted
and
to
so
talk about that.
I think when he finds out this is Balefire, and he recognizes, he knows this is Mila's son, I think Hook is torn. Hook is torn. He's been always by himself. He's always been abandoned. He's just like Emma. And all of a sudden, he's got this child. All of a sudden, Emma has Henry. All of a sudden, Hook has this child that he cares for. He doesn't want to care for him, because in the beginning, this is the Dark One's son. This mm-hmm. is the Dark One's son. This is my key to the revenge on the Dark One. But this is Mila's son.
He is.
How can he look at him and not see Mila? It's almost, if you're going to do the Harry Potter reference, it's Snape. It is Snape with Harry's mother. You have her eyes.
Yeah.
I mean, he's looking at Bay, and I think he feels fatherly towards Bay.
Definitely.
Were going to come and get you.
I got the impression that he is definitely becoming a foster parent to Bay, and it's enhanced by the fact that Bay seems to have rejected Rumpel as his father. So they join. They were kind of binding on that. In that respect as well.
Love is a powerful emotion, and mm-hmm. he felt such love for Mila. His voice cracked. The actor did a fabulous job. Every time he talked about, when he was telling Bay later, your father did this, I loved her. We were going to come for you. I mean, he was so emotional about it. And so I think going forward to where he finds out Neil Bay is Henry's son, mm-hmm. it kind of makes him the role of being connected to Henry as well. It's this could potentially be like my step grandchild.
Yeah. The reaction by Hook, like the things we do for our children, comes after, I think, one of the best moments in this episode, where it's the moment between Regina and Henry. So Regina tells Henry, I don't want to leave you. I don't want you to be alone. So we're gonna solve this. And then she tells him that she loves him, and he tells her. Actually, he's been calling her mom all the time, which must be very awkward and difficult for Emma to hear that. But he tells her, I love you too. And I don't know. I thought it was very well played and moving. And there is a clear parallel here, the theme of Henry, the threat of being left alone, the connection of Henry with Regina and with Emma, and then on the other side, contrasting with that, Hook and Rumpel and Bale, or Bay. And I love the way that they did that in this episode.
Can I just throw a Disney reference in there?
Sure.
And I don't know if it was that scene or it was the scene after where Henry's like, you know, we're not leaving people behind. I had a Lilo and Stitch moment. I'm like, Ohana means family, and family means... And I was in there like, oh, that's totally a Lilo and Stitch moment. Wow. So, yeah, not that anybody else would get that, but I was totally like, yeah, Lilo and Stitch.
Nice.
So, sorry.
I think my favorite line there was when this is the Regina coming full circle, starting to redeem, you know, find redemption. And we've been kind of leading up to it with the Regina and Snow conversation right before Snow figured out Regina killed all the people in the village. But she says, I tried to be the person that you wanted me to be, and I failed.
Yes.
But I won't let you be alone.
Mm-hmm.
And so she's sacrificing herself, whether she did or she didn't, so that...
So that Henry may be part of a family. Yeah. I mean, and there's a lot of, you know, betrayal of her own trust and the relationship that she had with her mother. And so there's plenty of repercussions of all these themes in all their backstories. And that's what makes this series so great, I think. It's just like, ultimately, no matter how different people are, they all have to find their way around the same issues, and everybody's longing ultimately for the same thing. And if they get robbed of love and family, that's when they turn evil. Let's hear the part where Bay tells Hook about his father.
If I tell you something, will you promise not to tell the crew? They might become frightened. My father. The reason why I don't speak of him is because he's the Dark One. He once was a man, but when I got drafted to the Ogre Wars, he wanted to protect me. So we went in search of the Dark One's dagger, and once he got it, he grew obsessed with the power it gave him.
He draws his power from a dagger?
Yes. It's the only weapon that can kill him. And the only thing he truly cares about anymore. He chose it over me.
That's a very interesting conversation as well. We know this, that the dagger is ultimately what gives Rumpel his power. But the emphasis here on the dagger is the only thing that can really kill Rumpel, that must have been very important to Hook, because when he hears about the potential destruction of Storybrooke via the counter curse or whatever, the failsafe diamond, he knows that it won't kill Rumpel, probably, and he needs that dagger. I was like, are we going to see a development later on in season 3 where Hook is going to go after the dagger after all?
They already have been after the dagger.
I know, but it still seems to me that you know, the fact that they mention it again, it's probably to say, it's just one of those, you know, story elements where they introduce a gun and it has to be it has to go off at some point.
See, I thought of it slightly differently, Father. I thought of it as they were showing you how Hook found out about the dagger, how Hook got that information that we'd already seen it introduced before.
I did too, kind of like a connecting the dots.
Okay. Right. You might be right.
If you watch the actor's face very carefully, I thought the actor did a great job. Hook is processing this information. He's looking at Bay. He's considering him very carefully. This, to me, was the turning point from letting go of my using Bay for my revenge and seeing Bay more as Mila's son. Wasn't it just earlier before that he was teaching him how to do the ship?
Yeah.
So he's giving him the sailing lesson. He carves the port and starboard, the P and the S, into the wood. Yeah. And that's the scene where they're sharing information, personal information about who they are and how they came to be who they are. And so I saw that as a real turning point in their relationship.
Oh, yeah. That was the him carving those symbols was the moment of the bonding, basically. Mm-hmm. And the fact that later on he puts a cross through it, that was the rupture of that bond. Yeah. Powerful.
The scene right before that was the Lost Ones coming on board the ship and searching the ship.
Let me play a short clip of that because that again, that was one of the most intense scenes in this episode. So here they come.
Do you know who we are? You're the Lost Ones. You work for him. We're looking for a boy who was seen adrift nearby. Boy, he has a particular interest in.
Then I'm afraid I'll have to send you away disappointed. As you can see, we're only men here.
Then you won't mind if we search your ship.
So the Lost Boys arrive on the ship, looking very scary, but most of them are masked except for the one with the shallow face. And I've got a couple of questions about that scene. First of all, how did they get on the ship? Where did they come from? Did they show that?
They were on a boat.
Yeah, we're on a rowboat.
Oh, they had a boat. Okay,
it was just lower. Yeah.
One moment, I thought perhaps they've been flying, but anyway, they just appear there, and then there is this. You know, he is looking for a boy, and apparently this has been a long-standing quest because this is what Hook has been trying to survive all the time at the first scene of the episode, they refer to that. It's, you know, we need to survive, and this boy might help us to survive in Neverland. So I don't know exactly why they are targeting Hook as the one who can bring them the boy. Is it because he can travel back and forth between realms or something like that?
No, it's because the shadow drops Bay in the sea.
Okay,
so he knew roughly where that was. So they have been searching the area because he has. That's also what he is saying in the clip, that he's been adrift somewhere in the neighborhood. So now there's this big ship sailing there. So they put one and one together.
But it almost felt as if they've been having problems with this mysterious person before. That there is
like
this
had
threat
run-ins with them.
Right.
Yeah.
I think they've been. Yeah. It sounds like they've been, or maybe, I don't know if tolerated is the right word, but they're just kind of trying to survive and not tick anyone off. And then now there's this boy that either he's on your pirate boat or he's with the mermaids. So we're betting he's with you. So,
yeah. And these are the Lost Boys, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, they don't
they
call it
lost
boys.
The
yeah.
Lost Ones is
lost
more
one.
Powerful.
They didn't say boy.
And they,
well, so there could be girls too, but we've only seen boys so far.
They look
my
like,
daughters thought that one of the Lost Ones was a girl.
Could be.
With her face covered.
Yes, that was my impression as well. That wasn't for nothing. That there has to be a reason for that. But they look like ninjas. One of them was carrying two swords on his back when they were searching the ship. It was like, wow. Very violent as well. And then when Hook is lying about Bay being on the ship, they're threatening him. And it's like, well, the punishment for lying is he will rip your shadow from you. And
right from your body.
Well, and then I was like, okay, that doesn't seem to me like a big punishment, not having a shadow, but it's almost as if doing that has huge consequences. That it is almost as if the shadow is, I don't know, a metaphor of your soul or something like that. You'll lose your soul or you'll lose balance in your life. And that made me think, we know that Peter Pan has been separated from his shadow. His shadow is evil, or at least seems to be evil. Peter Pan seems to be evil. So is that perhaps what they're referring to or alluding to, that if you get separated from your shadow, you basically lose whatever was good in you, or you lose your soul or something like that?
Maybe the shadow that came to take Bay wasn't Peter Pan.
That's true. Maybe it was someone he'd tortured.
He takes the shadow.
Yeah, perhaps he's done it to other people as well. There might be other shadows.
I liked the way that Hook said, no, but I gather it hurts.
Yes.
And did you notice that, okay, so you mentioned they all looked like ninjas.
Uh-huh.
Color and costume were very big in this episode. Everybody's in black. Mm-hmm. There's very, very little color, and it was in very specific places.
Okay.
Hook is wearing a muted red. Regina's wearing a very muted red. Charming's in a blue vest. Emma's all black. Gold is all black. Henry has the same striped scarf he always has. We're not there yet, but remind me, I'll tell you what Lacey's wearing and Belle is wearing.
Cool.
Smee has that bright red hat, which we already know the significance and the meaning of the hat. But I noticed it about halfway through, and I had to go back and look at every character once again. But everybody's in black except very minor muted color. And then it was either Snow is in that not quite purple, not quite pink, muted color again.
Mm-hmm. Well, but she's still consistent on her way back. She is slowly trying to redeem herself, I think. But interesting, yeah, I always forget to notice those, you know, color references. And I did notice that we for the first time since, I don't know, months, we got some sunlight in Storybrooke. It's like, wow, the sun is shining. They must have listened to our podcast. It's probably also because when they were filming, it was starting to, the winter was starting to be over finally. But
maybe it's a metaphor. Maybe they did it on purpose and the sun is shining because we're finally seeing a resolution or an end or a reconciliation.
Yeah, who knows?
Redemption.
The next thing we see is the dwarves in Mr. Gold's. I'm forgetting something?
Yeah. So at one point, the whole family is standing there and bickering. And so then they decide to split up. So Hook and David go to look for the beans.
Yes.
To get a portal.
Yes.
And then Emma and... what's her name?
Regina.
Regina go to the mines to stop delay.
Yeah.
And the curse. And Rest and Snow is just rounding up everybody to go together at Granny so they can jump through the portal at the same time.
Okay.
So then there's, I think, also a little scene with Gold, with Hook and David driving off to, or is it later that and they see Greg burning files?
Yeah, we'll get to that later on.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, we'll get to that later on. So the where was I? So
the dwarves.
The dwarves are raiding Mr. Gold's pawn shop, looking for stuff that belongs to them in the first place. Like that scene, and then we get a bit of a Deus Ex Machina type of story element, where all of a sudden we learn that the Blue Fairy has figured out how to restore the curse of people losing their memory when they cross the border of Storybrooke. It's like,
from how many of you went, oh, thank goodness.
Well, yes, of course. But at the same time, I was like, well, that's easy. And, yeah. You know, well, there was a missing ingredient and it was a hair from Pinocchio's head.
Ew.
Well, I was like, wasn't Pinocchio wooden? So what hair?
No, after she reverted him to who he should be, it was someone who had been returned to who he should be.
Uh-huh.
Someone who was a cursed.
A boy again.
So it was the hair
from the boy.
Oh, okay.
Like, what was so funny was Clark saying, what? We're going to die? No, I don't.
Was funny.
Yes.
Shut up, Clark.
Hear it?
And Grumpy's like, shove him off to Granny's, you know? We'll do it there.
Yeah. It's like, so you're gonna restore his memory just to tell him that he's going to die, and he's like, well, I don't want that.
Did you wonder though for a minute if Rumple was gonna do it? I mean, he had that look. I mean, was he enjoying Lacey, or did he really want Belle back? He had that look for a minute, and I thought, no, he's not gonna.
Yeah,
gonna
I
do
think,
it, right?
I think no, I think initially he didn't want to return Belle to her, you know, her previous or didn't want to give the memory back to Lacey, but
you know what triggered it? Did you capture the moment? What triggered it?
Oh, the scarf.
Yes,
the scarf. Well, we'll get to that. We'll get to that. We're jumping ahead of ourselves. Let's talk about a moment about the scene where Charming and Hook arrive at the harbor, and we see that Greg is burning tons of papers and dossiers in like an oil barrel or something like that. What was he burning? What was that?
What
any,
I want to
any
know
theories?
Is how come nobody locked down the crime scene? Nobody, you know, stationed guards at the at the cannery and went through and, you know, really went through and to see who are they working for? What kind of documentation do they have?
Well,
I mean,
the sheriff was busy.
Shelly, thank you.
She's driving me crazy.
Like, there is no technique whatsoever in investigation. It's starting to bug me.
True. Well, then, of course,
that's the technique.
Their police force is quite limited, seeing that the previous sheriff is
and
dead.
And nobody has any experience. So, yeah.
We know how fast Prince Charming just starts working with that gun. You know, it's like, forget the bows and arrows and the swords, you know?
He hit that out everywhere. Oh, tell me before I do something more than just
He makes me nervous.
Yeah.
Well, he's technically their law enforcement is really an unelected guy, and as technically their sheriff keeps getting sucked off into different worlds or going to New York or wherever, and so this guy has been completely unelected, just kind of runs around with a gun.
Yeah, but let's go back to the question. Hold on, let's go back to this scene. What is he burning, and why is he destroying evidence or whatever it is? Any ideas about why that is shown to us?
What he's burning has got to be something related to their mission, what they were assigned, what they were given. Gosh, if it was a business, they shouldn't have it in print. They should have it in emails.
It's not as dramatic to be seen deleting files from your phone. You know, that's not quite visual enough.
But is it part of perhaps files they have on all those people? But if so, you know, if the town is going to get destroyed anyway, why bother burning that?
You're bringing it up, I hadn't really noticed it, but since you bring it up, it must be just a plot piece to have Greg and Tamara still at the cannery cleaning up house so that Charming and Hook can have their little confrontation and get the bean and fight and have their little scuffle and let's live to fight another day. I mean, that's really the only reason, is to show that they were still there.
Perhaps.
Why did they go back? Oh, they got to burn the papers.
I wonder if it's not because they've been, I don't know, conducting research and it's part of the... I mean, I associate this with the whole theme of the Homeland Office, and that they possess, or the home, gosh, I keep messing it up. The Home Office. We should do a show about Homeland. The Home Office, where they probably have a lot of secrets. They clearly have a lot of technological scientific knowledge that is something they don't want to fall into the hands of the magical people. And so perhaps that is what he's burning, you know, some secret knowledge that we don't know about. That's kind of the only thing that I can come up with as a explanation for this. And then we go back to, this conversation between Hook and Bay, and Hook opens up to Bay and tells him about his father, that his father was a fugitive and left him. And again, it's a story element that makes me think, who is he referring to? Who was his father? What fugitive? What was he trying to fly away from? Do you think this is something that is just, you know, like something they made up to give Hook a backstory where he was abandoned too? Or do you think that this is setting us up for an episode later on where we will discover that Hook's father might still be alive, might still be around. Any ideas? Now that I think of it, what if Hook's father is Peter Pan?
Peter Pan is a boy.
Hmm?
Peter Pan is a boy.
Well, we don't know that.
We don't know.
We haven't seen him. We don't know how old he is. I mean, that would be such an amazing way to turn this story upside down, because the whole story of Peter Pan is between the antagonism between Peter Pan and Hook. What if that is actually an antagonism between father and son?
And
Hook, like Darth Vader and Luke Skywalker.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, it'd be a twist that could see them doing something crazy like that.
Peter, you got to remember in Pirates of the Caribbean, the third movie.
Yeah.
They did actually have Jack Sparrow's father.
Yes.
Who was played by Keith Richards.
Yes, absolutely.
And it could possibly, you're right. I think there will be some sort of, I don't think you're right about Peter Pan, but I think you're,
I'm playing the Star Wars card here.
No. Because, well, and it comes down to the very last scene where, and I hate to jump ahead, where we know who Peter Pan is actually looking for. And the fact that all this is fate is, you know, everything's predestined. And so I don't think Peter Pan could be Hook's father.
I think that Father's got an interesting point, that because my initial thought was, this is the setup to have him connect with Bay, and I've already talked about that. But it does, a second purpose, it does open a door and leave it open. Should the writers need that element to tie it back together? So it's open for them to revisit, but I'm not sure I agree with the whole Peter Pan thing.
It's
open.
It's a crazy theory, but
they introduce Hook as Killian Jones, and they don't do that by accident. So I think they have to connect, because that's such a part of the Caribbean name. So is Davy Jones his father? Something like that?
Well, Mike has an interesting observation in the chat room that might confirm my theory, or might hint at the fact that that Peter Pan is Hook's father. He says, you know, Hook is already missing a hand too. And remember that big reveal scene in Empire Strikes Back, like, I'm your father. Right before that, Darth Vader has cut off Luke Skywalker's hand. And we know that Hook got, well, no, wait a minute. Hook, who took off his hand?
Rumple
did. Ah, shoot. There goes
Rumple
my theory.
Rumple cannot be Jones's father.
Oh, well, it's getting complicated. We're all family, ultimately.
All a big soap opera.
Regina is then sacrificing herself to slow the diamond. She makes it clear that she won't come back, and she wants Emma to tell Henry that, you know, he always believed that it wasn't never too late to do the right thing. Well, tell him that he was right. I loved that scene. And then she says the following.
I created this device. It's only fitting that it takes my life. What am I supposed to tell Henry? Tell him that in the end, it wasn't too late for me to do the right thing. Everyone looks at me as the evil queen, including my son. Let me die as Regina.
So I love that. You know, everybody knows me as the evil queen, but I want to be Regina again. She wants to be herself, not just the evil that she did. So I think a very nice observation here that no matter how evil a person can be, the evil deeds cannot ultimately destroy who you are. You are not the evil things that you do. There's always a possibility of that good person, that initial person, to step forward again and be forgiven and be redeemed. And I thought this scene was so powerful, and it was so well played. You know, very subtle acting there, but wow.
That was my favorite scene, and when it came in the middle of the episode, I was blown away, because I didn't expect it to come so soon.
Yeah, this is kind of what you expect at the end, as a an emotional highlight of the series, but...
But it was such a transition for Regina. We've speculated for so long about could she be redeemed, and I think this was a major, major step towards that. We've always said it would take some sort of sacrifice, some sort of love for somebody else, puts everybody else ahead of her own personal needs, and she did. And she, oh, that line was beautiful. Let me die as Regina.
Absolutely. Well, I hate to spoil the fun, but we are approaching the end of this particular episode, our discussion of the season two finale of Once Upon a Time, and I still have so many notes, and we still have so many other sound clips that we want to play, that I propose that we make a two-parter of this, and that we honor the quality of this, you know, this final episode of season two by dedicating an extra episode. We've not done this before, but to dedicate a second part two to the discussion of the second part of the episode. Is that all right with all of you? I know that a lot of people that are listening now are like, no, continue. But I do think that if we would continue to discuss this episode, we would easily add another hour, especially with all the speculation, of course, that the end of this episode will solicit. So I think we can wrap this up right now and tell our listeners to come back for part two of our analysis of this episode. And then, of course, we will also talk a little bit about the preview that was aired, I think it was yesterday or the day before yesterday, with this sneak preview of the spin-off series about Wonderland. I was going to say Neverland, but it's going to be about Wonderland. And has anyone seen that yet? That trailer or that sneak preview?
I have not.
Inge, you saw it, right?
Yeah, I've seen it like half an hour before we had to record.
How does it look?
It looks great.
Yeah?
It's so I cannot spoil it, but it's okay. Kind of an interesting twist on the story. So by the looks of it.
Nice. So, of course, people want to hear our thoughts about that as well and where we think that spin-off series is going to go. But as I said, we will talk about that a little bit more in part two of this episode. So, to wrap things up, Deborah, I think that Secrets of Disney, if we're going to do the second season of that series, the first movie is probably already clear. I mean, it should be Peter Pan. Yes.
Yeah. I was totally thinking that too.
We have to start with Peter Pan. So people can find that on disney.sqpn.com. And perhaps in our next episode, we'll be able to tell you a little bit more specifically when that is going to happen. But in the meantime, if you've never listened to that show, check it out at disney.sqpn.com. Inge, we are going to ramp up our production of Secrets of the Hobbit, our discussion about the second movie, because there is news coming from New Zealand, and it seems
they have started pickup shooting for the second movie.
Nice.
This week,
yes, so. They already filmed a lot, but there's new stuff going on there, so we will probably also relaunch that series. Shelley and Lisa, you guys are still blogging away on your communal blog, right?
Yes. Well, we were talking about that this morning.
When time permits.
When time permits. Where can people find your blog?
It is soundmindandspirit.com.
Excellent. And David, are you still in for a second series of Secrets of Tintin?
Most definitely.
Absolutely. Well, all that is coming up soon. So we won't leave you alone when season two of Once Upon a Time is over. We would hate to do that. We want you to be part of this family, and together we will be in one big embrace and one podcast embrace and carry you to the third season of Once Upon a Time. We're all family. Thank you for listening to this episode. As I said before, SQPN is our main portal, and no, it's not a portal that will suck you into another dimension, although in a way podcasts do that. They bring you into another world for at least, you know, half an hour or an hour. You can find all our shows on sqpn.com, and as I said, we will be back with part two of our season's finale episode very soon. Stay tuned, and God bless.
SQPN. leading the way in Catholic new media.